You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, Studio Tulsa goes to the dogs as my guest today has introduced a new way of understanding and modifying our dogs' behaviors. Kim Brophy is an ethologist, which is a study of animal behavior, and she specializes in dog behavior. Dogs have lived with humans for perhaps as long as 30,000 years, but throughout a vast majority of those years, dogs have been bred to fulfill a specific role: herding, hunting by nose or sight, working or ratting. The idea of dogs simply as pets is relatively new. Using scientific research, Brophy has identified ways to help owners understand and teach their dogs, fixing unwanted behaviors and understanding the motivation for why dogs do what they do. Her technique takes information from over 20 scientific disciplines, provides four comprehensive elements: learning, environment, genetics, and self, or the acronym LEGS. Her new book is titled Meet Your Dog. It's published by Chronicle Books. She joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Kim Brophy, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rich.
Your book, Meet Your Dog, offers some really interesting insights into dog behavior. I love the fact that you use that name, changing dog behaviors, dog learning as opposed to dog training. We'll talk about that in a moment. But I want to start with, when we encounter a dog that has behaviors we don't like, we're very quick to label him or her as a bad dog. Why is it unhelpful to think in terms of good dog or bad dog?
Well, I think it's one of those concepts that caught on a long time ago in our historical conversations and attitudes about dogs, and it just hasn't been objectively challenged for its thinness in terms of its helpfulness in our lives with our dogs. So if you think about what our concepts are of a good dog or a bad dog, they're oversimplistic and naively, although innocently, ignoring the complexity of so many variables that are going into a given dog's behavior at any time. So as much as it would be erroneous to think about a human being as a good human being or a bad human being that are one thing or another in a black and white vacuum of either or, it is similarly problematic and unhelpful to think of dogs as good dogs or bad dogs.
Doesn't it really come down to the fact that if we like the dog's behavior, the dog's a good dog, and if we don't like the behaviors, they're a bad dog?
Well, I think right now that's the way that we're looking at it, and I think what the book is challenging is to ask us to look at our own perspectives and attitudes critically and to think about what our expectations are and whether they are realistic and reasonable for the dogs in our lives. What we find with many of the people that we work with as family dog mediators and behavior consultants is that so many of the things people bring to the table are their own projections, sometimes from their own personal experience, but often just from cultural mantras and indoctrinated thinking that we all have about dogs and what they should do and shouldn't do, what makes them good, what makes them bad. And they're observing or experiencing a behavior with their dog that they feel embarrassed about or they feel judged for, and they think they're supposed to change the behavior in their dog because of what other people's expectations are, neighbors, friends, family members, etc., when in actuality, sometimes the person living with the dog themselves doesn't even mind the behavior. They just think it's a bad behavior.
Now, you mentioned indoctrinated thinking. What would be one thing you wish you could change about the way people think about their dogs that seems to be ingrained within most people?
Well, one of the fundamental examples that I use for that is the idea that a good dog wants anybody and everybody to pet it. And I use the example of how you would feel walking down the street with a friend or your spouse and someone comes up and says, "Ooh, you are good looking. Can I pet this person?" And whoever you're walking with says, "Yes, please go right ahead, stroke away, you know, have at it." And then pushes you towards the person, and you might be reluctant or fearful, and yet the expectation is that you not only tolerate it but enjoy it, to the extent that we feel guilty if someone asks to pet our dog and we say no. You know, we feel embarrassed. We feel like, oh, my dog's not friendly. He's bad. He must have been abused, where there's really no other species on the face of the planet that wants strangers that they've never met to just suddenly come up and start fondling them. And because there are some dogs who do really enjoy that, who would solicit affection from anyone on the street, we think that that is the standard that all dogs should meet, when it's actually the exception if you're looking at the larger population of dogs.
It's just like people, right? Some people are gregarious. They can't meet a stranger. They're going to want to get to know that person, and other people are more introverted and are less likely to share anything with them or even really want to engage them in conversation, at least a complete stranger.
Exactly. And I think I would find myself erring on the side of folk who would be offended if people came up and touched me without permission on the street. Although I've definitely met those people at parties and on the street over the years that will come up and hug a complete stranger, especially in a town like Asheville here.
One of the things you write says, you know, we've lived with dogs for a long, long time. We've domesticated dogs for a long time. But the idea of dogs as pets, evolutionarily, is pretty a recent idea. And that's something we should keep in mind when we have a dog as a pet.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, on some level, people have been keeping, quote, pets for thousands of years. But when I'm speaking about the pet lifestyle, the pet environment, and the modern pet concept, it's something really different, meaning it is taking of a genetically domesticated animal and creating a captive environment. Now, we don't think of it as a captive environment. We think of it as pet luxury. But the things that are now normal as part of your modern dog's daily lifestyle and experience are inordinate amounts of time spent indoors. I mean, if you break it down, your average pet dog really spends about 20 to 23 hours a day in our home, right? And that's not their natural habitat from whence they came. Or is it providing the opportunity for them to express the instinctual behaviors that we've selected them for over the years? And so the whole pet idea is really something that the pet industry has marketed to us. And when we look at it objectively, it makes sense because the pet industry is, of course, in the position of wanting to market products and services to us as pet dog consumers in a booming business of pet products and services. And so they want us to look at this simplistically so that when they offer us a product or service that promises to make our pet happy and well-behaved, we want to buy into that, right? That's what they're hoping. So when challenged, however, we look at the big picture and see it is far more complicated than that, and the conversation needs to start shifting towards one that's more pragmatic and holistic if we're going to actually solve the problems that we're having.
You mentioned an analogy in the book, which I thought was very telling, and it asked us to put ourselves in our dog's shoes, and it's as if every day we're in an airplane. We get on an airplane. Occasionally we get out in the terminal about once for maybe 30 to 40 minutes. We go outside in the fresh air. We go back into the terminal. We get back on the plane and repeat day after day after day. And I thought that was a really interesting analogy of this is the pet environment.
Yeah, and for so many dogs with really great, loving, well-meaning owners, that life of being in a small enclosed area is their reality. And, you know, zoologists for years have been aware of and trying to be responsive to the dynamic needs of the animals in their care, right, in zoos, where they've gone out of their way. I'm sure you've noticed the improvement in zoos and their environments over the years to create these enriched and dynamic habitats that more closely resembled the natural habitat of those animals. And we have all been conditioned into thinking that the whole concept of an appropriate habitat is irrelevant with a pet. And the reality, of course, is that it's not irrelevant at all. And if anything, with dogs, it's more consequential because we have genetically selected dogs to such extremes of behavioral specialization in their historic jobs that they, in many cases, are only well suited to a very specific set of circumstances, no longer as adaptive as they would have been as a natural species. And so a herding dog is the poster child for that. You take a herding dog bred to work an 18-hour day on a farm, and you put them in a condo in a city, and they are living that airport example lifestyle of being crated for, 10, 12, 14 hours a day in some cases. And then they leave the apartment, go for a walk 3 times a day for 20-minute opportunities to relieve themselves, and then they go back into the box. When that animal is exhibiting neurotic, stereotypical, compulsive, aberrant, or aggressive behavior, it's not appropriate, correct, or even humane, in my opinion, to give the animal a, quote, dog training service prescription and one from Prozac from a veterinarian in order to address what is really a far larger problem.
That dog needs to have lots of room to run around. It needs to have a purpose for most herding dogs. They absolutely need a job.
Yeah, they are workaholic animals, and mentally even more than physically, they need to be solving problems. They need to feel like they are important, that they are a wingman to someone and their endeavors in life, and have their cup be filled. They are the people that you know that are workaholic, go-getters, problem solvers. They're not going to be content just to sit around at home by the fire.
Use an example in the book of a terrier that had lived on a farm for several years and seemed to have an amazing, happy existence. And then the owner moved to the city, had to move into the city. And the dog was either in a house or an apartment. And the dog seemed to be seemingly going mad. And you found that there was actually a very simple answer that explained the dog's happiness out on the farm and why it was having such difficult behaviors, you know, to the owner's view, from being in the city. What was it?
Well, so in that situation, this is a little dog named Dexter, and he had been running around from one end of the house to the other, up and down a particular line of internal walls since she had moved into her new home here. Which, you know, wasn't a bad environment at all, but it was a small fenced yard compared to the farm that he came from. And he was running back and forth, frothing at the mouth all day, every day, to the extent that he was no longer eating, he wasn't playing, he wasn't interested in any other activity. He would just go outside to go to the bathroom and then come back in and go back and forth along the wall. And the owner was concerned that the dog had developed obsessive-compulsive disorder and had spoken with her veterinarian about getting some medication and then got our phone number and came to meet with us. And when I went to the home to assess the situation, I had a sneaking suspicion that this was not an obsessive-compulsive behavior at all, but that there were actually mice in the walls, and Dexter was going out of his way to let us know as a terrier with all of the instincts to locate and do something about these varmints that have infested the home, he was letting the owner know. So she ended up calling an exterminator upon my recommendation and finding out that the house was actually infested with rodents. And once those were treated then or humanely removed from the home, then Dexter was able to resume a more normal, healthy existence, although she did have to go out of her way to make sure that he got plenty of exercise and problems to solve in other capacities.
And that also explained why the dog was so happy out on the farm.
Exactly. She thought he was just running around sniffing things, but he was probably hunting rodents a good deal at the time.
And this gets into the basis of your book, this theory that you use for understanding your dog's behaviors, and it's called LEGS. And, of course, that's a mixture of environment and genetics. It stands for learning, environment, genetics, and self. Tell us a little bit about this behavioral understanding.
LEGS was the result of my efforts to resolve a problem that I became aware of some years ago, about halfway through my 20-year career. I had a sudden realization that the integration of sciences was failing to reach the industry of pet dog training and behavior. My background had been in applied ethology, which is the study of human and animal behavior in captive or domesticated species. And as an interdisciplinary field, we are tasked with looking at all of the different variables, as a zoologist would be, for a captive or companion or domesticated species in their learning, their experiences in life, their environment, their habitat, the genetics and biology they bring to the table, and then their individual internal conditions, the self. And yet my industry was not talking about all of these different scientific variables and factors and contributors to an animal's overall welfare very often. It tended to be a very L-heavy, learning-heavy industry. And so I dug back into all the different disciplines and started compiling, you know, research principles, understandings, insights from all these different fields. And at first, it was a very daunting, overwhelming body of information. 20 different plus scientific disciplines had something to offer to the conversation. And in my efforts to boil it down to something that was even manageable to talk about, particularly for a pet dog owner, someone not in the industry, we needed a framework that was tangible, that was useful and applicable, that would still ensure we weren't leaving any big stone unturned in our conversation. So legs then becomes the framework for our discussion. If someone brings a dog to us, or if someone has a dog and they're looking at the behavior problems that they're experiencing, they can step back and look at it with legs. They can say, okay, so is it a learning issue? Is it because of some experience the dog has had, some habit the dog has developed, an idea that they've formed in their life? Or am I having an environment issue? If I'm really looking at what the dog's needs are for his environment, is there something that's going on in the environment that is either causing the behavior that I could change, something about the environment I could adjust that would address the behavior, something that's insufficient? And then genetically, what is it that then informs what my dog needs in their environment and their learning? What is it about my dog's genetic ancestry that created what would be the ideal appropriate environment for him? And am I sticking a square peg in a round hole somehow in my situation that I could simply resolve by shaving off some of these edges here for the environment that I have in order to create something that will work with him? And then with the self, what are the internal conditions that the dog is bringing to the table that are also out of his control? Is he a puppy or is he an adult? Is he intact or is he neutered? Is he healthy or unhealthy? You know, fed well or underfed or having some type of a dietary issue? Does he have a disability, a disease, et cetera? All those things are going to affect their behavior. So learning, environment, genetics, and self, legs, becomes what we hope will be a new practical framework of discussion that can be the paradigm-shifting starting point for our concept about pet dogs.
My guest today is Kim Brophy. She is a canine behavioral consultant and animal behavior specialist, ethology, and she's the author of Meet Your Dog, The Game-Changing Guide to Understanding Your Dog's Behavior. It's published by Chronicle Books, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things that when I was reading the learning section was the idea that, you know, for so much of us, when we were wanting to change behaviors in our dog or to encourage certain behaviors in our dogs, we refer to it as training. Mm-hmm. And it's really not training, is it? It's we're teaching the dog, and the dog is learning.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that's one of those other great examples of an indoctrinated concept that we've all bought into, is the whole notion of dog training. And as someone who's very much smack in the middle of the dog training profession, I am inviting a market disruptor to the entire concept of dog training, because it really, it puts us in the wrong starting point in the conversation. It connotes my will. Dog is supposed to be subordinate to my will. It is my minion, and I train it by programming it in an hour a week or an hour a day or what have you to do what I want it to do and to have, if you think about the words we use, quote, obedience, quote, obedience to commands, right? And that's what the process of dog training is. The reality, of course, is that all species, all animals are learning all the time. Every single moment in life is a precedent for the next or something else. So they are doing the math all day long about what things mean, what the results of various choices and behaviors and actions are in their environment. And our job is to set up those variables so that we can have a conversation with the dog, so that we can explain how things will best work in our life together. But the whole idea of dog training is about as silly as thinking you're going to take your spouse to get trained. You know, it's lovely, it's appealing, of course, to think, well, I want that fixed. I don't like that the man leaves his socks on the sofa every night, right? But it's not about training. It is about getting on the same page. And what I like to think about as literally a contract of terms between two species, two individuals having a relationship, in the same way that any relationship comes down to being a contract of terms.
Getting back to some of the myths on training that you write about in the book, I've heard this an awful lot in recent years, establishing ourselves, the owner, as the alpha dog.
Right.
Talk about that if you would, because you have a few thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, it's really funny, again, for a number of reasons, if you really examine it. The whole concept of the alpha dog came from some studies that were done on wolves years ago, long since proven to be outdated and specific to how wolves behaved, even in a captive environment, not just a wild environment. But the long short of it is that, A, dogs aren't wolves. They're a separate species completely. And, B, even if they were wolves, the idea that a dog would be under the impression that we are also a wolf, or that a dog would be under the impression that we are also a dog, is so completely absurd and yet goes on unchallenged in many cases. So in the same way that any species out there, you know, whether it's a snake or a fish or a horse or whatever, can look at us and go, well, you're not the same as me. You're not my same species. Dogs and wolves, of course, would recognize that we are not theirs either. So when we go in and we try to dominate the animal with these things that we've seen on National Geographic or other television shows about, you know, how you, a wolf or a dog would put another animal in their place through an alpha roll or a scruff shake, the dog perceives it as a completely absurd gesture that is clumsy, inappropriate, left field, and threatening. And yet people will still go out of their way to do those things, not even stopping short of such extremes as biting their own dogs on the ear or on the neck. And I've had many such clients who have tried these things over the years, not because they're bad people, but because they had bought into the idea of the alpha wolf model. The reality in nature is that, just like with human behavior and human politics and history, if you look at it, dominance is actually scientifically about control of resources and control of the situation, the chips, if you will. And so as a captain of a ship, we hope, or the leader of a company, would have ideally the best interests of all in mind and the best ability to manage, in an upper management sense, the variables of what is occurring moment to moment and the delegation and decision-making of what's happening with the environment, not with the individual. That's what dominance is, versus what we think of as dominance is actually more like domineering, where you engage a battle of wills, a pissing contest, so to speak, and then try to win that, like my will over yours. That's what happens when some natural, practical dominance control of the situation is not already clear that's functioning for the group or the relationship.
You know, getting back to the old good dog, bad dog idea we discussed earlier, you know, when a dog, you have a moment, a behavior that you don't like, the dog, you know, maybe soil the carpet or something like that. Eventually, you know, the dog will sense our displeasure and they'll give you that look, you know, the look that, oh, I know, I'm so sorry. That's not, you're right, it says that's not what the dog's doing. The dog knows that that look will lessen whatever has displeased us. And I thought that was a very interesting, it was an interesting take on how a dog learns.
Well, and I think sometimes we forget, if you think about it, we humans do the same things. You know, if we feel like someone is threatening us and we want to turn it off, we look away, we kind of grimace, we make ourselves smaller, we squint our eyes. You know, there are normal social kinds of behaviors that might look apologetic, but the function, as far as survival, is to turn off the threat, right? So when we come in and we put our hands on our hips and we say, you are a naughty dog, the dog is going to respond with evolutionary adapted skills, not just related to other dogs, but evolutionarily adapted skills related to their history with human beings and how well they read human emotions, human body language, facial expressions, and they have evolved. They have learned, one individual in one moment at a time over multiple generations, these incredible ways of turning off our threats and appeasing us in order to ensure that the relationship stays solid, healthy, and productive for their own interests going forward. It's not about, oh, I love you and I'm so sincerely sorry, like we want to think that it is. Now, we don't know for sure what's going on there, but we don't, as far as we don't know how far those feelings might go for the dog. But there's been a lot of research on guilt and whether dogs experience it. And the more pragmatic explanation for all of it is that dogs are simply turning off our threats that we're giving in those situations, hands on the hips and eyebrows furrowed.
Now, are certain dog types better at reading humans than others?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So certain types of dogs have been selected for their close cooperation and function with human beings. And so herding dogs, for instance, and gun dogs are two examples of types of historical working groups that had to work very closely with humans in order to accomplish a job. So herding dogs being kind of the peak of that. They were selected to micromanage, control, respond to other animals in an environment, like a flock of sheep, and to respond to sudden changes in movements and adjustments in the environment in order to control and regulate those animals. but they were also very deliberately, simultaneously selected to look to us for information and feedback in that process, lest our border collie take the flock of sheep three counties over, right?
I mean, so, it's the idea is you say do it, and the dog says it's done.
Right, exactly. You know, we want to be able to maintain that thread of constant conversation, and anyone who's ever had a herding dog knows that it can be unnerving to live with one because they are almost reading your mind. They are so aware of every nuance of your movement, your thinking, your emotions, your nerves, your behaviors, your gestures, that you almost can't get a moment's rest. I mean, I used to feel like my Australian Shepherd that I had years ago just was a constant eavesdropper, and you have to spell everything out because she's searching for any clue in what you're saying in order to make sense out of what was going to happen next.
One of the interesting parts of your book is the dog type section, where you go through some of the attributes and some of the things that might frustrate a dog owner about that particular type of dog. Everything from natural dogs, which I assume that's dogs more closely to wild, originally wild species, like Malamutes and, you know, snow dogs, for example, sight hounds, guardians, toys, scent hounds, gun dogs, terriers, bulldogs, and then what you called world dogs. I guess that's the Heinz 57 varieties. But maybe take us through a couple of those. Say, for example, very popular terriers or very popular dogs to be kept as pets. What are the things to keep in mind?
Well, terriers are really wonderful companions. They are suitable for indoor environments, although they might constantly bounce off the walls of the interior of your home. They do well in indoor environments because in many cases, historically, they were living in indoor environments, whether it be, in a home, on in a farm building or structure, or an industrial building, or whether they were even kept on ships and brought overseas in order to keep the rat populations on ships down years ago. And so they do well in indoor environments, but they have a tremendous amount of energy. They are hypervigilant and always on kind of ready mode because, of course, rodents are going to take any opportunity they can to take advantage of the spoils in an environment. And we needed terriers historically to help eradicate those threats to our own safety, livelihood, resources, et cetera. And terriers fit the bill when we didn't have home extermination services, right? So that being their background, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that they are going to be a busybody, but also that they have a genetically intact predatory sequence. So the predatory sequence is one of the primary things that was selected for, against, modified for exaggerated components or muted components, thus resulting in all the different types of dogs that we now see. So we might have a dog that will not follow through and actually grab, bite, and kill bite an animal, but will chase it more voraciously, thinking of a herding dog as a really good example. So they have an exaggerated eye stalk chase behavior, but a muted grab, bite, kill bite behavior. A terrier is going to have the whole sequence. So to have a terrier kill a small animal is not actually a genetic mistake, but it is something that we have little tolerance for, obviously, in our pets. So it's something people need to be aware of and make sure that they set the dog up for success with if they are to have one in their home.
It's a real interesting book. The name of it is Meet Your Dog. Kim, thanks very much for joining us. It was really great.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Kim Brophy is a canine behavioral consultant and animal behavior specialist and the author of Meet Your Dog, The Game-Changing Guide to Understanding Your Dog's Behavior. It's published by Chronicle Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.